At first, gambling starts as a pleasurable activity, and then becomes a need. What used to be pleasurable isn't pleasurable anymore because your whole reward mechanism with dopamine is messed up. But if you actually remove the gambling without necessarily taking care of what's underneath, well, something else might latch on and start to sort of become the self-soothing behavior or mechanism to cope with that emotional difficulty.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the One Day at a Time podcast. Today's guest is Yusuf Alami. He is a clinical psychologist and a professor at Laval University in Canada. Thank you for joining.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Of course. And I think this is going to be an interesting one because we haven't dove into these topics yet on the channel. But today we're going to be talking about different motivations for people to gamble, the difference in risk according to the type or context of that gambling. So don't worry, we're going to dive into that. We're going to talk about the potential risks of switching to another addiction as you begin to try to leave gambling in the past. So Yusuf, once again, thank you for joining. What motivated you to get into the work that you do before we dive into what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, for sure. So it was back in the day when I was completing my PhD. I was looking to study delinquent behaviors. So people who commit any sorts of crimes, people who tend to do dangerous behaviors, but don't necessarily get caught. And then I found this professor who not only did that type of research, but also had a project ongoing on gambling. I was like, whoa, gambling. Well, that's interesting. I know people all around me who gamble. I sometimes gamble here and there, but I wonder how can we actually study such a topic and what could eventually lead someone who may gamble recreationally to a more problematic or addictive form of gambling. And I've been in the field since then. I've worked in a rehab center in the public sector here in Quebec, and I have a private practice in the field, and I've been doing research in the field ever since.
That's awesome. And you and I are actually working on a research study now. I don't think we can talk about it yet, but once we have the results, I'm sure you're going to come on for a follow-up and we can talk
absolutely
about it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Absolutely.
For people that don't know, before we dive into the meat of the content again, like, what's the gambling scene like in Canada, in Quebec? Because in the U.S. it's 21 to gamble. You know, there's people doing it younger, but what is the legal age, and does there seem to be a problem going on?
Okay, so basically, similar to the U.S., we have a sort of federal level and then a state, or we call it a provincial level. So it's the federal level that will determine whether it's legal or not. And yes, it is legal, but then the federal level gives the power to decide on these things to each specific province. And therefore, each province has actually its own legal age to be able to start gambling. So in Quebec, for instance, you have to be at least 18 years old to be able to gamble. But our neighboring province in Ontario, it's 19 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's between 18 and 19, according to the various provinces. And something that's sort of interesting or specific to Canada to a certain extent is that in some provinces, there's actually a state monopoly. So it's a government-owned and managed business that provides not only lottery, but also all sorts of online casino games, online poker, and those types of games. Whereas other provinces have this sort of open market type where private operators, private companies can purchase a license to be able to provide their services, if you want to call them that way, to the population of Ontario, for example.
I know that a lot of the biggest streamers in the world, like Exposed and like Drake, actually stream from Canada on a platform called Stake.com, or actually one used to stream on Rubet. But these are operators that are in Canada as well, I believe?
To be honest, that will depend on the province. And given that I'm in Quebec, I can tell you that it's illegal for them to operate in Quebec. But then each province will have their own sort of rule. So for example, right now it's around 82 websites, I believe, in Ontario who are allowed. And it's possible to go check online the specific companies. And these companies change all the time. So I won't be able to say if those two specific companies you mentioned are actually allowed to operate here. Something that I find to be so not only dishonest, but misleading is the fact that you have this superstar making millions of dollars and just casually betting for 100K on a game, a million on a game. And we don't know, or at least now we do, but at the time we didn't know that he was actually receiving all this sponsorship from these companies. So is it actually even his money that he's actually using there? Not only that, but as a person, you know, just scrolling through social media, you're there, then you see Drake and you're like, oh, that's interesting. And you see him, you know, lose 500K and you're like, well, 500K, that's huge. You know, I just lost $100. Maybe it's not that bad. So it sort of desensitizes with the actual, you know, importance and relative risk associated with losing.
Shameless plug, I just released a video on this exact topic. I'll link it up at the top of the podcast for people who are watching. But we've totally normalized the fact that you're betting $100, $250, $500, $1,000 a spin when you're seeing your favorite streamer do it. You know, even if you're not, as you said, going to that extent, if say you lose a fraction of that, you're going to say, oh, well, at least I'm not that guy. I'm fine. And it's completely people to risk. And I want to dive into that topic. But first, let's talk about how people even get to the point that they're gambling. Sure. You know, I think that in context, a lot of what I've heard since I've entered the space has been, you know, people either gamble because they're action gamblers and they want the excitement, or they're trying to escape something like maybe trauma or boredom or sadness. What are the motivations that you're seeing for why people are gambling today?
I'll try to describe, let's say, three major profiles that we tend to see, not only in research, but also in practice. You have this sort of first group. Life is good, just living their own lives. They probably do good at school, do good at work. Things are going well. And then they get exposed through friends, through family, maybe through an ad they saw on TV, and they try to gamble for the first time. They play, maybe they have a win, a major win, and then you have these sort of conditioning processes happening in the back of your brain that lead you to believe that, well, if you continue to gamble, maybe you will be able to win. So that's how a first subset of people get into gambling and maybe increase their participation in gambling. This first group, we tend to find that they suffer the least from gambling problems, and they're the easiest to sort of help get out of it. Second group, you have what we would call the emotionally vulnerable gambler. These are people who would, for example, go through difficult events in their past, traumatic events, all sorts of abuse, and then eventually, again, get exposed to gambling. Beyond that simple conditioning part of sometimes I win, sometimes I lose, there's also the alleviation of depressive symptoms, alleviation of anxiety symptoms that happens when they get in the zone of their gambling. And what happens there is that when you sort of couple both of these mechanisms, so the classical conditioning part and the emotional alleviation, well, it sort of reinforces even more the behavior of gambling. And therefore, for these people, we tend to find more severe problems, more enduring problems, and it's tougher to actually help these people get out without, at the same time, addressing the underlying vulnerabilities, depression, anxiety, or possible traumatic events. Third group, imagine this sort of hyperactive, always sensation-seeking, drives 100 miles on the highway, loves to bungee jump, skydiving. This person who's mostly sensation-seeking. So it's not only gambling, it's also all sorts of substances, it's also all sorts of risky behaviors, and there's this sort of thrill in doing something risky. And then take that sort of pattern and add onto it the conditioning processes, and it's another form of motivation and conditioning that interact, that lead to the person who gambles. So to sort of summarize, social reasons, coping reasons, and enhancement reasons. And then sprinkled through these, you have financial reasons. Gambling because you actually want to make money. Gambling for conformity reasons. It's the Super Bowl and all your friends are betting and you want to be part of the crew, so you're also betting. So you have these sort of various types of motives. And what's interesting to see is that depending on the motive, the risk of developing a gambling problem is actually different.
Is the treatment process the same for each category? Because I would think that it's important to know then which category you're in terms of how to go out and actually find help.
Absolutely. And the thing is, there's a sort of common aspect or universal aspect where we would talk about gambling fallacies, certain erroneous beliefs about the relationship between my behavior and the outcome of a gambling activity. So that aspect is sort of universal to no matter which group you belong to. And by the way, I say group belong to, but you may belong to two groups at the same time. So there's also this thing to keep in mind. But then, for example, for the emotionally vulnerable group, you must, or to be the most effective or to be able to help the person, also be able to target those underlying mechanisms. And maybe we'll be able to talk about it a bit later, but if you actually sort of remove the gambling without necessarily taking care of what's underneath, well, something else might latch on and start to sort of become the self-soothing behavior or mechanism to cope with that emotional difficulty.
I'm trying to think of like the reasons why therapy didn't work for me. And what I think was maybe relevant to it could have been this discussion is when I was seeking out help, I felt like I was trying to, or we as we were working through our sessions, we were trying to solve these underlying issues that I'm not sure I even had. We were trying to cure feelings of depression. We were trying to use meditation to center myself. All right, I'm feeling depressed, I'm feeling anxious. But I think I'm feeling depressed because I just lost a bunch of money. I'm feeling anxious because I don't know where to find more money to pay it off. And so having these categories ahead of time, it could have changed the entire method in which I was getting help and maybe found myself help 3 years earlier than I did.
Absolutely. And thanks for sharing that and that vision of how you understand what happened. The thing is, one of the ways that we actually try to sort of categorize or distinguish these categories is that we try to assess depression and anxiety relative to the gambling behavior to try to figure out that was it there before or was it a consequence, as you say, of, financial loss, relationship tensions, or something like that. Absolutely.
Someone on a live stream the other day just asked me, like, what traumatic event did you go through to get you addicted to gambling? And I honestly don't have one. So it's
No.
like I struggled to give an answer there. But so what you're saying is you don't have to necessarily have trauma to develop a gambling problem.
Exactly. You don't necessarily need to have trauma to develop a gambling problem. However, if you have been through a traumatic event, your risk significantly increases in order to be able to. But it's not a necessary condition in order to develop a gambling problem.
Can we talk about something real for a minute? If your gambling has started to feel less like fun and more like stress, trust me, you're not alone. Millions of us know what it's like to say, just one more bet, or feel that urge that's really difficult to explain. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Evive, a sponsor of today's video. Think of it as having a recovery companion right in your pocket, someone who actually understands what you're going through. No lectures, no pressure, just practical tools and genuine support when those challenging moments hit. Download Evive now and you'll get guaranteed free access through 2026. Not a trial or a limited version, but the complete platform, completely free. Because Evive believes that everyone deserves access to support that works for them. Download Evive today and take the first step towards changing your relationship to gambling. Evive is only available in select countries. So within like different types of gambling then, to give like context to maybe people who are watching that are sports bettors versus slot machine players, is there a specific type of gambling that's more addictive than others, or are the risks kind of the same across the board?
Thank you for the question. We actually published a study on that topic in 2021. And what we did is that we actually tried to rack up as many risk factors as we could, not only in terms of the specific types of gambling that people engage in, so slot machines, sports betting, roulette, poker, lottery. And we also looked at whether the person had certain mental health problems, concurrent use of alcohol, 54 different risk factors. And we all ranked them through hundreds of studies where we combined the results through all these studies to get a sense of out of these 54, who's number one and which one is the least. Would you want to venture in and try to guess the first, or would you like me to just go ahead?
I feel like the most obvious answer, which I think people might know, is that slot machines are the most addictive form of gambling.
And there's this sort of hybrid that you could only find in not only in slot machines, but also on land. But it was basically online gambling. So first one, online, but right below that, you've got slot machines. And then there's actually a difference between whether it's slot machines in a bar, because in certain states and certain provinces, you're allowed to have slot machines in bars, whereas others you do not, and whether it's a slot machine in a casino, in a large casino where there's a whole bunch of staff, you know, walking around trying to check in from time to time, is everything okay? So it's worse, relatively speaking, slot machines outside of a casino compared to slot machines inside of a casino. So that sort of starts to get us to think about the importance of the context in which gambling happens beyond the specific behavior that someone is actually engaging in.
Wow. So yeah, I mean, thinking about it like that, I guess it would show the reasoning for gambling venues to invest in prevention methods to have people going around and checking up on people within their venue. Do you think that's realistic though? Do you think it's like fair to ask some of these places to make less money?
Well, that's very not slippery slope, but a gray line where sure you want to ask them to make less money, but at the same time, if everyone who walks out of there is in a horrible state, well, it's bad press for them too. And that doesn't necessarily make them look good in terms of their social responsibility for the population. If we take an example of, for example, how Quebec works, where there's a state-owned monopoly, well, it's basically the government. How would the government want to look knowing that they're also creating all this sort of distress, all of this mental health wise, financial wise, relationship wise? So there's this sort of balance that these types of operators need to take into account that I don't think that some operator based in the Bahamas would have the same worry about in terms of social responsibility. So the response to your question would vary or depend according to what type of operator we're talking to and talking about.
Got it. And within that bucket of categories, what was listed as the least harmful or the least addictive?
Lottery play.
Really?
Lottery play. And I'm not talking about the instant lottery, like the scratch tickets, but lottery play. And why? Well, lottery, where Monday I purchase a ticket, maybe my draw is in 2 days or in 4 days. You don't have that sort of immediate reward, immediate satisfaction of your behavior, as opposed in this whole spectrum to slot machines, where it's 12 events per minute, and your brain is getting triggered. Yes, no, 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 no. Yes, no, no, no. And the more rapidly this happens, and the more fluctuating this is with all the sounds, with all the stuff that surrounds it, that increases the risk of developing a gambling problem. Whereas the lottery, which is sort of a boring, relatively speaking, form of gambling, tends to develop the least problems.
The least, but not zero, because we got to keep
There
it
you go.
not here.
Absolutely.
But that does make sense because it comes down to frequency, essentially, frequency, intensity, stake amount, pacing, like this kind of thing.
Absolutely. All these events and elements that you find in slot machines sometimes is the ratio between how much you actually bet and of your potential return. So that ratio over there, the higher it is, the more likely you are to actually, fluctuate in your bets, spend more time, which is also why certain jurisdictions, like in the UK, sort of limit or have a quota of different types of machines according to various ratios. So some of these, you can only have a maximum of 5x or something like that. So they try to sort of limit the risk by also manipulating that.
That's fascinating stuff. A lot of the slot machines that, as far as I'm aware, also have something designed into them called the near miss fallacy, that goes along with the payout ratio. Do you want to talk about what that might be for those in the
Sure.
audience that don't know it?
Absolutely. So basically, in the near miss fallacy, there's this idea that, oh, I was so close to winning. And there's idea that if I was so close, it was just out of reach. But in reality, it's either you win or you lose. There is no I am so close. And the way that they try to trick you with that is the fact that, for example, just to simplify, I'm not going to talk about those slot machines with five rows over here, five rows over there, and all the different combinations. Let's just imagine a very simple form of three different columns, I need to have a row of three. So a seven, seven, and a seven. So you get your first seven, you get your second seven, and then you got your third column turning down and you see that seven and you see it so close and it stops right after it. Your mind says, oh my God, it was so close. Maybe if I had actually hit the machine or if I had pressed the button just differently, then maybe I would have gotten a different outcome. But the truth of the matter is, at the single moment, at that specific time that you press the button, whether it's slightly, whether it's like strongly, or you hit or caress the machine or whatever, the outcome is determined even before those turns start to turn. It's at that specific second, microsecond, that is determined, and all those things turning are just show for them. And that's how near misses sometimes hit you with slot machines, but you could also see it with lottery. Hey, I was one number away from hitting the lottery. I put 35 instead of 36. It feels so close. But whether you have a 35 or a 1 or a 6, the outcome is the same. You've lost.
What I wanted to ask you was, what is really going on in the brain of someone who's playing a slot machine? Because there's this idea, like in this book that I read and reviewed very sarcastically, that there's a way to beat these machines. But what is going on in the brain of someone playing one of these machines that is convincing them to keep going? Is there actually chemicals being released that are motivating them to play? Like what is going on?
At first, step to eventually that goes through someone's mind that eventually leads them to want to gamble more on these machines is that when they have their first win, there's this satisfactory molecule that is released in the brain. You've probably heard of it, dopamine. And what it basically does is that it tells your body what I'm doing now is good for me. So you get it when you eat healthy food. You get it when you eat junk food, because there's this also aspect of fat that your body used to think 20,000 years ago that it was good to store fat. So there's this idea that when I do this behavior, it's good for me. When I win money, it's good for me. So there's this idea that a big win starts to create that connection in your brain where dopamine gets released and says, do this behavior because it's good for you. So eventually you try to do it more and more and more. But once you, it's a repetitive behavior, it's as if you're sort of walking in a forest and you keep taking the same path over and over and over again, while all the branches sort of go to the side and you have a nice, easy to follow path. And once you keep taking that one and only path, looking at the rest of the forest seems like such a hassle, so complicated. All I want to do is take this path that seems so accessible and so easy to navigate. So it's sort of reinforcing the same behavior again and again and again.
Which kind of begs the question of like what we've titled this video. Why can someone with a gambling addiction not just stop? They're seeing that path. They're seeing that, you know, this is something that makes us feel good. But there's also all these negative consequences that are coming along. It's lies. It's losing money. It's maybe losing your family, your house, your car, your job. All this stuff that's bad is happening. Why do they keep going down that path?
Something we've noticed in a few studies and a few readings and in a few stories is that at first, gambling starts as a pleasurable activity, and then becomes a need. So if we try to do a sort of comparison with certain substances like heroin, for example, or other types of opioids, at first it's relaxing, but then you start to have these withdrawal symptoms where your body starts to hurt. It starts to really feel painful. And the only thing you can sort of do to alleviate that, at least temporarily, is to engage in that same behavior. So at that certain point, gambling becomes this sort of route to alleviate a need that is not even pleasurable anymore, but it becomes so conditioned and omnipresent, always present in one's mind, that there's this tunnel vision where someone is led to only see this as a potential way of alleviating this uncomfortable emotion. And the sort of difficult part in the way that our brain is built is that even something that used to be fun, like playing soccer, playing football, dancing, or whatever, what used to be pleasurable isn't pleasurable anymore because your whole reward mechanism with dopamine is messed up. So basically, even let's say football, where you used to play and it was something fun, well, now if you actually try to play football, it's not as satisfying. And you actually need to push through once, twice, thrice, keep going until you sort of dig this new path in the forest where eventually your brain starts to again find it to be rewarding, helpful. And it's by diversifying these different sources of pleasure that eventually you could be able to, you know, sort of let the trees grow back in your gambling path, and it seems less appealing at that moment.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times what I'll hear from someone is like, I can't stop gambling because nothing else in my life brings me any pleasure anymore. Like, gambling is the only thing that makes me feel good. So what you're asserting here is that's a normal feeling.
It is a normal feeling, unfortunate normal feeling in that state of mind where these other activities, even if they used to be pleasurable, that they don't at that specific moment help or matter. And that's where in these cases, what is often helpful is to work through these events with someone that's sort of like a therapist or someone else or group therapy that sort of helps you from time to time focus and connect with yourself, with your values, and eventually find something that you find meaningful, even if it's not necessarily pleasurable at that specific moment.
Gambling can absolutely wreck your finances, but you don't have to fix it alone. At GamFin, they help people struggling with gambling debt to take back control. Whether it's budgeting, debt management, or rebuilding your financial future, their experts are here with real solutions. No judgment, just support. Your money doesn't have to define you. Visit GamFin.org today and take the first step toward financial recovery by meeting with one of their financial advisors. Hope starts here. If someone's watching to this point and they're not really understanding a gambling addiction yet, but they're like beginning to see a little bit about it, one question that might come to their minds at this point would be, noting all of this, is it still the gambling addict's fault if they're the ones that get hooked to it? Are they doing something particularly different than someone else who doesn't have a gambling problem? Is their addiction their fault?
The way that I see it and the way that I work through people with gambling addictions in therapy, I look at it as a complex problem where there's the environment, the society in which we live in. There's the person's history. There's sometimes a genetic predisposition to actually developing these sorts of problems. There's the type of gambling behaviors that the person engages in. And within all of this, well, sometimes someone is constrained into taking the gambling route, even beyond them choosing to go there. It's as if it's the only available option to actually self-soothe through emotional difficulties. So my job with them is not to say, hey, look at yourself, you've chosen the worst possible option to self-soothe. It's actually to empathize with what's underneath, and through that, try to find alternative ways of self-soothing. And then depending on the person, whether they choose to be completely abstinent or just sort of gamble from time to time or specific forms of gambling, that's how I work through them to be able to hopefully find a more meaningful life. I have never to date said to anyone, it's your fault that you have a gambling problem.
Okay, so if someone wants to stop gambling, they're starting to do new things and they're all boring. They're not getting any pleasure out of it because their dopamine pathways are messed up. Yeah. Is that when they're at the highest risk for developing another addiction?
So what we start to find is that, first of all, some people will develop another addiction and others not. So we're trying to figure out why. Who are these people who actually switch or substitute is the more technical term, substituting addictions. And what we find is that people with emotional vulnerabilities who have been through difficult traumatic events in their earlier lives, they are the people who are most likely to substitute addictions. Mm-hmm. And the most plausible hypothesis, and we're still trying to figure this out through research and other types of approaches, is that gambling in this instance is the coping mechanism. If you remove the coping mechanism, but you don't either find an alternative way to cope with it or actually treat the underlying anxiety, depression, or traumatic event, well, nature hates the void and will find a way to latch on to something else that will eventually become the substitute. For some, it might be a more socially desirable form of addiction. But for others, it could be another addictive behavior, another addictive substance. And that might also lead to problems family, work-wise, and or elsewhere.
What do you think are the biggest questions that need to be answered in the space of problem gambling research to make a real difference for people who have gambling addiction?
First of all, and this is not only true for gambling, but also for other types of addictions, there's the behavior or the product. There's the person and their personal history and whether they went through difficult events, and there's the society. And within these three realms of intervention, well, there's still much to be learned, and especially in terms of the interaction between all of these. If you took me and you put me in another society, would I be more at risk to develop a gambling problem? Maybe. So am I the issue, or is the society the issue? And how do I interact with a given society? In that sense, there's the idea that it's a never-ending quest because society changes all the time. So it's constantly something that we need to figure out and see according to where we are now, what's the best way to be able to support people with gambling problems. And then there's the idea that I'm not too sure how it is in the States, but my guess is that it's fairly similar. Current treatment centers for gambling are extremely rare. It's mostly substance use. So if you're someone with a gambling problem and you try to seek help, well, you don't actually have options. Sometimes your only option is either Gamblers Anonymous or you need to find some resource on the internet. And if you actually end up setting foot in a substance use facility, well, people aren't too familiar with gambling. They sort of minimize it, or they don't see that it can be actually as severe and as harmful. So there's this idea that even for gambling, it still needs to be more widely implemented in our society as something that deserves to be treated, that deserves to be helped. Governments tend to put a lot of money in substance use treatments because it costs them a lot. You see, for example, emergency rooms filled with people who either got into accidents or whatsoever, or who are going through an overdose. But people with gambling problems tend to fall through the cracks. And those who fall through the cracks eventually only become apparent when they actually end up harming themselves. That makes it such a disappointing fact in the way that our society and treatment facilities are built to date.
As a 26-year-old, or just about to be, who had to get his own health insurance in the U.S. for the first time, I'm realizing how terrible our healthcare system actually is. And I know as a fact, like, most insurances don't accept problem gambling or gambling addiction as a real issue, and very, very difficult to get an insurance company to fund problem gambling treatment. The treatments are constrained because they're not able to actually follow through and do what they need to do, which is why there's, I think, like 6 treatment centers in the U.S. that are gambling specific outside of state-based ones.
And it's something that I believe nowadays, unfortunately, like, my guess, if I were to bet on the topic, it would be to guess that with these upcoming years, with people spending more and more time on their phones, Zoom meetings and all that type of stuff on their computers, so getting more and more accustomed to being on the internet, and the way that social media are built and the way that you get to have all these opportunities to gamble nowadays on cryptocurrencies and all these new forms of gambling that fall beyond regulatory capacities of governments. So the huge challenge, in my opinion, and I have no clue how to manage this, is to be able to regulate, legally speaking, all these other forms of gambling that don't appear out in the open, but in certain areas of social media.
If someone is on that border of wanting to seek help for a problem versus continuing along the same path, what would you say to motivate that person to make a change?
Very often someone who reaches that point don't necessarily feel that they have the capability or the capacity to be able to change. They don't know how, or else they wouldn't be in that specific problem at that specific time. But very often, if they decided to try to do something, it's because it starts to become important for them to be able to change. And I just want to put it out there that there are a variety of different types of help. I've been talking about individual therapy, but it's not the only one. There's group therapy, whether it's Gamblers Anonymous, where it's sort of peer supported, but there's also more formal group therapies. There's also sometimes for certain people with comorbid difficulties like anxiety and depression, it could be useful to have sort of antidepressants to support the idea of more focused gambling help. Self-exclusion is something that should not be dismissed. It's something that has been reported as being a great way to sort of take a step back, think about alternative ways to sort of get pleasure in various activities, take a break to think about one's life, what's important for someone. And coupling self-exclusion with another form of help has also been found to be much more helpful. So there are a variety of ways of seeking help. And what we've seen is that the more you combine these options, the more helpful it tends to be.
Yusuf, thank you for joining. To anyone that's watching that wants to read some of his research, check out the description of this video. We're going to have a link down there. And if you're interested in seeing a story of someone in recovery from a gambling addiction, then watch this video. And let's keep getting better together, one day at a time.